The next guest that we've got up here tonight, this is going to be a real pleasure to have this gentleman on, somebody who has, we talked about previously, very accomplished guy. Very few people in their lives make it to the point of playing with one big-time group. He's done it more than once here, the most famous of them being Santana and Journey, making the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame with Santana. Presently, a very noteworthy project that it is out with his own band that he's got, the Greg Raleigh Band, and a limited edition CD of the band in concert called Rain Dance. So we've got a lot to talk about with this gentleman here. But again, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Greg Raleigh, in the FDH Lounge. Greg, welcome to the program tonight, sir.
How you doing?
Fine, thanks. How are you, Greg?
I'm great.
It's a pleasure to have you on. Previously on the show here, it's interesting. We've only had on a few folks over a period of time that have been in bands, but just kind of a weird thing here. Previously, we had on, of course, your old bandmate, Steve Smith. He's one of the other guys from the world of music who's been on with us, who, again, I'm sure I don't have to tell you, you know that better than anybody, one of the very greatest of all time at his, you know, on the drums there, no question.
Yeah, he is. He's great. He's one of the best drummers around. I haven't seen him in years, but it's been about 5-6 years maybe I've seen him. I hardly see any of those guys anymore. You know, we all went our separate ways, and saw Ross Valerie when I played in Pleasanton, California. He came by because he lives close.
Mm-hmm.
And but other than that, you know, it was like every year or two or something I might see somebody.
Separate ways, very very apropos. But yeah, that's what can happen sometimes. You know, at bands. We'll sometimes splinter, and people will come and go. You yourself have had a heck of a career, really done a whole lot. I know that our FDH New York Bureau, who got you booked, again, you are a big favorite of his, as you are with a number of us, with a number of people. So he was happy to get you booked for tonight, but additionally, the timing of it as well. And I think that's where I like to start here tonight. We just had the milestone come and go recently here, 40 years since Woodstock, you being somebody who played there. I guess the thing that, and I don't think I've interviewed anybody before who played at Woodstock. So I guess the first question that would come to my mind would be, with all the mythology of it and what it was like for, you know, the great performances of over a couple of days and, you know, the rain and the mud and all of that, what part is there of the mythology of the way people think that it was that rings as inaccurate to you? Or does that whole picture that everybody talks about of those couple of days pretty much cover it accurately?
I can't remember. You got another question? No, I'm kidding.
If you remember it, you probably weren't there, right, Greg?
Yeah, no, that's the old story. No, I remember pretty much what went on. It's 40 years ago, and everything becomes kind of hindsight. And I think the major point that everybody needs to understand is that Michael Wadley actually filmed it. There was a ton of big festivals, 50,000 people, well, you know, which of course got dwarfed by Woodstock, but they were big and they were huge and we played a lot of them. And so this was just going to be another one. It was supposed to be 200,000 people, but kind of like Close Encounters, everybody showed up and went to the mountain. You know, I mean, they just had to. So it ended up being 500,000 people. People parked on the highway. The highways were closed, but they had to regroup on how they were going to get bands in, and then they had to regroup about what band was going to play when, because some of them were stuck on the freeway. And so it became pretty much of a mess, but I think the real story behind it is the people that went. The 500,000 people is the real story to the thing, which is, I think, portrayed a little better in the re-release from Warner Brothers of Woodstock 40, which has about 3 more hours of information in it, and it kind of tells the story of how it was done. Wadley wisely filmed from the get-go, before, you know, Yesler's farm, while it was a farm, all the way to the garbage at the end. And so you really got a picture of what was going on there. And now they've talked to people you know, 40 years later, and I think they've added things like that. I haven't even seen it all yet, and plus new performances. So there's bands there that nobody knew that were there. For instance, Creedence Clearwater. I didn't know they played. We played one day. We went on earlier than we were supposed to, and we stayed there to see Sly Stone, and then we drove out, and that was it. And I knew of the bands who played just like everybody else after the movie was out. We didn't consider it to be, at the time, we never talked about Woodstock after we played it. It was like on to the next thing. But because it was filmed, and it has become the grandfather to all of these things, and there was no violence, and it was a moment in time of a bunch of kids telling the world how they think it ought to be, and it was filmed. It became what it became, and now it's, you know, nostalgic and almost a myth and in history all at once.
You know,
that's the best way I can explain it.
Well, that's a good explanation. You mentioned a couple of things there, I think, that lead to some potential follow-up questions. I wasn't even thinking along these lines until you said something late in your response there, in passing almost, about how it was nonviolent. But have you ever allowed that to cross your mind, now that I think about it, as far as it being something like Altamont? I mean, what if it got ugly? Has that ever crossed your mind that, like, thank God it never came to that? Or with all these people there and all the drugs and everything that was going on, what would have happened if it ever would have gone that way? Has your mind ever allowed you to go there in terms of what it would have been like to try to survive a scenario like that?
No. As a matter of fact, I think the whole point to it is nobody thought that way. And that's why it worked. Nobody thought of it that way. They just went there to go enjoy themselves. And so nobody's looking for a tough time. I'm sure there had to be a scuffle here and there, but nothing, you know. Altamont was it was one of the most poorly planned things that has ever happened, and which, you know, happened, I don't know, a month later, 2 months, whatever it was. Can't even remember. We played that, too, and I saw a guy get beat up right in front of me while I'm playing, and it's not really what I signed up to do. And, you know, and it was ugly, but the stage was 3 feet off the ground. You can't do that with 200,000 people. Woodstock was better planned. It was a huge stage. People could see it. They couldn't, you know, it was more organized in that fashion. They really tried to do things right. They had a revolving stage that broke because the weight was too heavy for it, so that they could move bands on quickly, and they ended up having to do it the same old way that everybody did. And but they tried to. Michael Lang really thought this stuff out as best he could. And Michael Lang's an interesting character because he looks the same. And I asked him, how come? I mean, I look pretty good, but this is ridiculous. And because I don't stress over things. And the more I think about it, if he didn't stress over Woodstock, then he doesn't stress over things. And that's why he looks and feels as good as he does.
Well, maybe that was the key to the planning, the fact that the guy doesn't stress out a lot. Because, as you said, it was sort of one extreme to the other, planning Woodstock and everything that went into that versus Altamont. I mean, the bottom line on Altamont, sometimes you can sum up something in one sentence. The Hell's Angels doing security, okay? Whoever thought something could go wrong with that, huh?
Well, you know, Jerry Garcia, the Grateful Dead, and Janis Joplin, and the airplane, all they were all friends with the Angels. I knew a bunch of Angels,
okay,
too. And, you know, apart, yeah, they were okay, but given that scenario, I don't think that was too smart, and obviously it wasn't, so it ended up being a disaster.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the end of all of that. But getting back to your question about Woodstock being that way, no, never crossed my mind. In fact, it never crosses my mind to go play music that violence is going to be involved, although it has happened.
Well, that's,
you know, I think most people don't go there for that, at least from that generation.
Sure.
Nowadays, you almost have to expect a little problem here and there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, depending on what musical acts are involved, yeah, it almost...
Yeah,
went.
I mean, whoever's got the gig, you know, sometimes they bring an entourage of people that are looking for trouble.
Yeah.
It's a different world, that's all.
It can happen, definitely.
Yeah.
The other question that I would have for you about that would be one of scope, because you were talking about, you know, you guys did a lot of big festivals and 50,000, you wouldn't blink at that, whatever. this is what I wonder about. You know, for a band like yours that was used to being on huge stages like that and playing on stages the likes of which most bands can't even dream of, how big of a difference is there in scale between 50,000 and 500,000? Like, in terms of stage fright, in terms of anything that you might have there, is it a deal where if you're comfortable playing the 50, 500's not going to rattle you? At what point, if any, does it kick in and you start thinking, oh, my God, this is the biggest thing that we're ever going to be a part of?
I think it's a little scarier to go play a small club.
Okay.
Because, I mean, they're right there.
Yeah.
I mean, they can see your eyeballs, your, you know, nose hairs practically. So they're going to get a whole eyeful, earful, and up close and personal. I think that's a little more difficult than it is to play to a big crowd, because it becomes almost impersonal, but it's not, of course, but it's not the same. It's and between 50,000 and 500,000, hey, after the first 10,000, it's all hair and teeth. So it just is wave of brown. That's what it looked like. And plus, during Woodstock, Santana was the type of band that we played like jazz players. We played to each other almost in a circle. And it wasn't like necessarily projected towards the audience, like Sly Stone projected everything towards the audience. He was like, he was brilliant, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And but we played a whole different way. We wanted to be an internationally known band, and we played to each other, and it was all about the music. And there just happened to be 500,000 people there watching what we do. That's kind of the way we approached it. So it never, playing to 500,000 people did not strike me until we left, because we flew in helicopters. You can't tell a mountain of people, but you really have no way of judging it.
Mm-hmm.
And at least I didn't. But when we drove out, what I was telling you about the personal, I mean, there they are right there. You could see their nose hairs, too. And you're driving out, and it was forever to get out of there. And then it was unbelievable. So if we had driven in, it might have scared me to death.
That's really interesting. I mean, you know, some people might think that that's counterintuitive, but I can kind of get where you're coming from when you're face-to-face with a smaller group of people. And I can tell you that, too. Just, you know, I can relate to that, because when we've done remotes, like here from the station, I find it more daunting to be in a room full of people as opposed to, you know, however many people are out there listening to us, which dwarf, you know, whatever's in the room physically listening to us. But, yeah, I guess that's just a human thing, you know, to find smaller settings.
Sure. The other thing is, for a musician, or at least for me, is speaking instead of playing.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking, like, you know, I get just as nervous as anybody else.
Sure.
And but playing music, I don't.
Well, that's true. Yeah, I guess if that was a problem for you, you probably wouldn't make it that far, right?
There's a lot of people that have done it. Red Skelton used to get sick before he'd go on to do his comedy. Practically throw up, and which was amazing to me. The guy was brilliant, but you know, he had a sense of stage fright. It was probably what I've been talking about. Oh my God, they're right there.
Uh-huh.
I better be good.
Yeah, it's only human, I suppose, to have that happen.
Yeah,
you know,
I'd
it's
like
a wonder
to be called that. That would be good.
Yeah, I guess it's a wonder it doesn't happen to more people, but you know, in terms of the overall musical journey that you've been on, which has sort of culminated with your present band right now, one of the next big steps along the way for you, you know, you played with Santana. That was where you you know, made your bones for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Part of another band that I think, well, most of us fully expect will be there someday in Journey. And talk about what that was like again with you as the vocalist back in the day, pre Steve Perry, and then you know, fading into, you know, somewhat of a dual role with him, transitioning, being a versatile part of the band. Talk about what that was like to be able to play different roles with a band like that and do them all well.
Well, number one, Journey was, when it started out, was more of a fusion rock band. It was about solos, kind of where Santana left off, at least for Neil and I.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of soloing, and but the songs were not Latin or Latin-based. And it was more rock-based and into fusion, you know, almost jazz. But it was rock. And the way we wrote songs was, it was based on the thing that got everybody high was all the solo work, and so we played on that. The band could play; we could sell more tickets than we could sell albums. And back then, record companies actually gave you a chance. We put out three records, and they backed them as best they could during that time period. And we would go out and tour, and you know, sell out a lot of places. And so the band was really primed and ready to go. It was well known throughout the United States. You know, it was a theater-filling band at the time. And then we made the decision, or actually, I think CBS made it for us. They wanted us to have a singer, a lead singer, because that was the day of the lead singer. You know,
mm-hmm.
And everybody had to have a focal point. I thought the Beatles did fine with three of them, so yeah. I don't know, and even four actually.
Uh-huh.
But that's the way the business went, and so we went after a singer, which I actually wasn't opposed to because I had been doing lead singing, playing two or three keyboards at a time, and harmonica, and kind of spread out. So this would be different, and why not? And so we started writing songs at that point after the next album, Into Infinity, when Perry got involved, to writing songs for singing and doing actual backgrounds, and something I'd never done, not to that extreme. And so it was a total flip-flop from what I was weaned on, which was Santana. And kind of difficult to try and figure out how to go about all this stuff. Also, instead of a lot of minor keys, there was a lot of major keys. And so it was just a complete flip for me, but I enjoyed it, and I liked doing it. I liked having the dual vocals and things of that nature, and I didn't mind taking a backseat on singing at the time. And so, you know, it became what it became, and it just started to explode. We had to beat it up. I think, you know, Santana was a phenomenon. That we kind of put this together, and we caught the a generation of our time, and we caught the timing was perfect. There was, you know, being in Woodstock, Bill Graham loved the band. It was just a million things that happened, and so it rapidly went skyrocketing into being known. And Journey was more of a working project. It was. That's the part that I was very impressed with the manager, Herbie Herbert. He just stuck that out, and we kept pounding, and, you know, within about four or five years, it started to really grow. And then, of course, when after the Captured album, which was my last one, I picked Jonathan Cain to replace me. I had no idea that he could write some of the stuff that he wrote, but... He could play anything I was playing, and he played guitar as well, and so Neil kind of wanted that. And so on my exit, when I left, said, you ought to look into this guy, and says that's what they did, and they got a hold of him, and the rest of it is, you know, 80 million records later. There you go.
On a side note, and I have a few more things I want to ask you about music, but on a side note here, I'm reminded of when we had on Steve Smith, and if I remember correctly, he sort of disabused us of the notion that Journey Escape was the continuing cash cow that everybody thinks it was. Wasn't there some kind of a deal cut where you know, everybody probably thinks that you guys are, you know, living in houses of 24-karat gold off of that video game, but it didn't quite work out that way from the way he portrayed it.
Oh, from you know what? After I left the business, I left it all to those guys. I just kind of walked away and you know, let them go on about their business. As far as the escape stuff, I have no idea.
Oh, okay. Okay.
They should have. I got a feeling that they did better than what Steve said, but I have no idea. I really don't. I can't answer it.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know if you knew anything about that or not. What strikes me here, I'm just... I'm seeing a sense of segues in terms of looking at your career that just seem kind of smooth and logical, because you talk about the early days of Journey having a lot in common with Santana, minus perhaps some of the Latin influences of it. Certainly one would look at your career and look at Journey and then everything that you did with The Storm and see a lot of similarities there as well. It seems as though, you know, it just, A, from some of the core members being the same, but also stylistically, was that another case of things just kind of, you know, flowing in kind of a smooth manner for you?
Well, actually, no. As a matter of fact, I started writing some songs with Kevin Chalfant, the singer from The Storm, and we were just going to write some songs and see if we can get them placed.
Mm-hmm.
I was kind of out of the game, and Interscope Records was just starting up, and Herbie Herbert, I sent him a couple of the songs that I wrote, and he loved them, and he, it's a funny story, Bo Hill, who was vice president of Interscope at the time and in charge of that style of music, asked Herbie, he goes, is there any bands around that you know of? Da-da-da-da. He goes, I got a ton of tapes. And they were at a show, and he was in his Mercedes, and he pulls out a tape, and it just happened to be ours. He slammed it in his machine, and Bo Hill goes, who the hell is that? And he goes, it's Greg Raleigh. He goes, you're kidding me. And so I got a call from them about that, and I started up a band. He goes, I love your stuff. It was arranged to be, at first, just a solo act, you know, and I would have Kevin sing on this and that. I said, I think I got a better idea. What if I got Smith and Ross Valerie and myself? You got something more to talk about, three guys from Journey and Kevin Chalfant, and the guitar player was Josh Raymond. And we'll take it from there. And we just started writing songs, and I had a co-writer help me, Bob Marlette, that co-produced the second album, I believe it was. At any rate, we wrote these songs, and one of them got to be number 13 or something, and then Interscope changed who they were going to be. I've Got a Lot to Learn About Love, and it became a huge hit. And if we had had one more out of there, we might be talking about something else right now.
Interesting.
But Interscope changed who they were. They went to Nine Inch Nails and rap from there, and they went with the flow. I couldn't be mad at them. I'd already had my day in the sun twice. Not bad.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the modern image of Interscope as we've come to think of it over the last 15 to 20 years, that direction.
Sure.
that you described there. What I'm curious about, again, with The Storm having had as many Journey alums as it had here, something I'd like to ask you about. This was something that our New York Bureau, our producer, had dug up in the course of his research here. This near miss, at least in terms of that's how it's been reported publicly here, on a Journey reunion and tour in 1994 here. I mean, the word is, just from I guess what he had come up with and from what's out there on the internet, that there was a moment where it looked like it might happen. You guys, Steve Perry, all getting together to put it back together. It didn't happen. What was the story behind that?
Well, it was prior to Perry being involved. The real deal was that it was pretty much designed by Herbie and Neil, that they were, well, let's go out and do this. And they called me, and I was involved with possibly doing this. And I think along with Jonathan, which didn't bother me, that'd be fine. You know, you play what you play, I play what I play. It could be enormous and a lot of fun. And that just did not happen. Perry got involved, and exit Herbie and exit Greg. And that's kind of where that went. I don't think I have to disclose too much of why it happened.
Sure.
I mean, here comes Perry, and there goes everything up in smoke.
Okay.
So that's just the way it went. And those guys went on to do a CD. I mean, that was when the Eagles came out and did sort of the same thing, the same idea. They got themselves back together, and they went on a tour, and I think Fleetwood Mac did it, and there's a bunch of bands that did it. And if had that had happened with Journey, the thing would have never lulled for a second. But that didn't happen.
Well, it's an interesting thing to have you comment on, yeah, because it's intriguing that it came so close to happening and yet ultimately didn't. So sometimes the things that offer the most intrigue are the ones that don't happen for whatever reason. And
You got to remember one thing. Sometimes you just can't go back. It's just, some people can, some people can't. And if they can't, they can't, and that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what was going on there. There's a lot of political games and things that I think most people are over at this point, from
okay.
that. But that it is the way it is. It's like I don't think I could go back and do Santana again because it won't be the same. It's almost like you would no fault involved. Just
sure.
It's like you would expect things to be a certain way because that's the way it was when you left. And it might not be. And sometimes it's just you got to leave it alone,
Oh, sure.
It turns out to be better. For instance, with Santana, I'm very proud to have been in both bands, but especially Santana because we created something that nobody had ever done ever. A type of music. And at the time, I never looked at it that way. We were just playing. But I never looked at it as though we created a style of music that nobody had ever played before. And that's a real feather for me. I'm real proud of that, and I love that stuff. It's kind of why I went back to it, because I was weaned on it, and every time I'd sit down and play something, it would be in that genre or blues. It's always that. So I just stay there.
Sure. And now to ask you about your present band, which is sort of the culmination of our conversation, fittingly, because it seems like in some ways it's the culmination of your career, the Greg Raleigh Band. We've got a CD that's on the way from the Glass Onion folks. I'm looking forward to checking it out. For right now, all I can go by is the material that I've read about that and everything I've come across in that way. And it seems to have a lot of influences from the work that you've done throughout your career. I mean, it seems to have a little bit of the classic Santana sound, as you've been talking about, some parts of Journey, I'm guessing probably more so the earlier days of that, more of like the jam session type part. But why don't you describe it, Greg? When people come to see you, and oh, by the way, I'm looking at your schedule here. Our flagship city for the network is Cleveland, Ohio. I see that you're going to be in the suburb of Avon at All Pro Freight Stadium on September 19th. You also have a date in Palmdale, California at the amphitheater. But for the folks coming out to catch the remainder of your 2009 tour, how would you best describe the sound of the Greg Raleigh Band?
Well, I went back to my roots on Santana. I play the major songs from the first three albums, and then new material that's in the same genre. And the reason why it's got a little the newer music has. How do I put this? When I got into Journey, I learned how to craft a better song. And so it wasn't just a few more changes, a few more melodies, just a little bit different stuff. It's still in the same genre, but the songs are crafted pretty well, and there's a little more to them in the new material, but it is still... I hate to use the term Latin rock, but that's what everybody likes to call it. And because it is a combination of Latin, blues, jazz, rock, you name it, it's in there. At any rate, so that is what I've been doing. And the band plays this stuff unbelievably. And that is the CD you're going to get. You'll see it. Like I've been coining the phrase, it's Santana the way you remember it.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. I'm looking forward to that. And I just happened to notice this on your website, really, as we were talking now about the tour date. I'm hopeful of potentially being able to get out there to All Pro Freight Stadium in Avon myself to check it out. But at any rate, Greg, it's a pleasure to have you on. Of course, your website, gregraleigh.com. We always like to give everybody a chance to plug on this program here. In addition to this CD and anything people can find on your website, anything else that they should be aware of?
Well, you can purchase that on CD Baby. You can go to Avalon, iTunes, all of it, everywhere. So if they're interested in it, there it is. I've gotten some rave reviews about this CD, and which is great. It's really about playing live for me at this point, though. It's like, this is a limited edition.
Okay.
We're not going to make a ton of these, I don't think. So unless there's, it goes off the chart somehow, but we'll see.
I can't wait to hear it. Greg, you've had a fascinating career all through the years, and of course, much great music, I'm sure, ahead of you. It was a pleasure to have you on the show for the first time. We look forward to doing it again sometime, sir.
All right. Thanks, Rick.
Thanks so much, Greg. Greg Rowley, everyone, from the Greg Rowley Band, previously of Santana and Journey.